we're in the process of doing a cost of service analysis for our water division. And so we thought that it would be a good idea as part of that to have this presentation to where we can explain what we do when we do a cost of service study to help us determine rates. So we've hired Stantec Consulting to do this cost of service study. Now with that, I'm gonna turn it over to Kyle Stevens.
Perfect. Thank you, Dave, and thank you all so much for being here this evening. As Dave mentioned, what I wanted to do is go through a presentation here of the steps for the cost of service study that are already underway. We're moving through, and we're going to preference tonight's conversation. There's no recommendations or findings that are going to be shown tonight, but rather the core steps and methodologies that will be used to arrive at the conclusions that we'll have later this spring with a report at the conclusion of the study. And so with that, I've got an agenda up here for the items we'll run through tonight. I want to talk about not only the study process, but also the utility space and water in particular has some unique challenges that all utilities are facing. I want to talk about, and they influence the rate study in multiple parts, mainly on the cost side of the equation. Then we'll talk about the several components that are, make up the full rate study. So revenue sufficiency component, which is how much money do we need, cost of service, how do we divide that revenue requirement up among customers and the ratepayers? And then finally, the rate design, where the rubber meets the road. How do we actually design the rates that we charge customers to generate the required revenues on an ongoing basis? Also talk about a couple other components that are part of the study this year. So miscellaneous fees will be in there, and the project timeline as we move forward through the winter here into the spring. But first, just wanted to give you a background on Stantec. So we are one of the larger utility rate consulting practices in the U.S. We serve about 25% of the overall U.S. population. So do studies for little municipalities up in Michigan of 200 or 300 people, all the way to New York City and everywhere in between. So we've got a good range, and we really look forward to engaging with communities to come up with custom solutions, right? Understanding the unique provision of service and making sure that the studies are customized to meet a sustainable plan going forward for water rates, sewer rates, stormwater rates, all of the different types of utility services that a community might provide. So the first slide up here about the rate study is really to help us think about what we're going through as we start this. And I like to think about it as a series of interconnected investigations where we're asking questions and trying to get an answer using the data that's relevant to the local municipality, in our case, your city. The first is, how much money do we need? And so we think about all of the different expenditures that go into providing this service, water in this case, which is a very infrastructure intensive service, right? We've got to have all of the pipes in place and the treatment plant to provide the service 24/7, 365 days a year. And what we want to do is, as part of this study, not only think about 1 year, but also try to project out and think over a multi-year period the types of investments and renewal that need to happen on the system to keep it functioning and providing the level of service that the community looks forward to. And then once we have that question answered, we move over to the from who question, the real fundamental cost of service question, which is we break down the system to think about the different functions of the system. So supply, treatment, and then sending that water out to customers. How do the costs break up? And then we mesh that with system data to understand how our different customers use the system. One of the biggest components in the water utility industry is peaking, is the idea that we have certain loads that happen throughout the year, but then typically when we get to the summer months, there's a big spike in demand as irrigation demand comes online, and the system has to be sized and installed to meet those demands, of course. And so we really think about the different customers, how they use that, and then the costs are attached to that usage of the system. Now, what that forms is targets for the amount of revenue we need to generate by customer class that we then can use in the next step, which is rate design. So what we want to think about in that case are those rates that you'll see on your monthly bill that come in that determine that overall bill. They are broadly broken up into two different categories. One are fixed base charges. Those are the component of the bill that doesn't vary with consumption. So it's a flat rate each month, usually based on the size of your meter. And then the next component is going to be the volumetric charges, based on the amount of consumption that you use in a monthly period. And in a minute, I'll show you the current rates and how they interact with that usage. Before we go into the elements of the rate study, though, I wanted to put these challenges up because we don't operate in a bubble in the city of Columbia here. We operate within the broader confines of this industry that has a number of forces interacting on it. The one on the top left here shows the residential in-use survey, which looks at different appliances within the household and how usage has changed over time. They do this every 5 to 10 years. We're close to an update right now. The last one was done in 2016. The issue here is, as we move forward, there are large efficiency gains, meaning water consumption tends to fall over time on an average connection. And if you think about that, we have installed a system, it's been in place for a number of years, we have less units that means to bill over time. And so this can be actually a challenge, even though it's a good thing on a customer's side of the equation, it can be a challenge on the utility side to make sure we have enough revenue coming in as this occurs throughout the system. Aging infrastructure. In much of the U.S., infrastructure was installed the 50s, 60s, 70s. That infrastructure's been in service and is coming to a point where it's midlife or at the end of its life in a lot of cases, and we have to think about renewing it. And the cost to renew that can be really substantial. And we have to factor that in when we think about those long-term plans of the investments on the system. And in regulatory, we all know as we move forward in time, things tend to get more complicated, and regulations tend to get more broad in their application. And as new scientific advances come up, we tend to find regulations down the road that impact this industry. And those then are costs here that we have to think about going forward. Aging workforce, I put that down there on the bottom as well. That's not something unique to the water industry or utilities, but it definitely impacts us, right? As long-tenured employees leave, that institutional knowledge leaves, and we also have to confront a tighter labor market, right? So that directly impacts our costs. The next one, and I'll talk about this in a bit more detail, customer affordability. Many of these different elements push in one direction, the direction of higher cost over time. That tends to push on certain customers and cause affordability concerns. So we always want to be mindful of that as we're thinking about projecting rates into the future. How does it impact all of our customers, and especially ones that may have affordability concerns? So first, I'll jump into the revenue sufficiency side of the equation. And as we think about this, really it's an effort of bringing the different puzzle pieces together. So within the city, we have a number of different elements, cost elements, that impact the provision of water services. And so around this chart here, I put those different elements in place. So starting on the top, you know, we have the operational type costs, the personnel, the crews that are on the system, as well as our operating expenditures. But as I mentioned, this is very capital intensive. So a large amount of the cost is on the bottom. It's going to be related to those capital investments we need to make over time, as well as debt service. If we need to borrow the money to make big generational investments in the system, oftentimes we have to repay that over a number of years. We also have to keep reserves on hand, right? Things don't always happen as we expect. We might have unplanned repairs on the system. We need to have a little bit of money in the bank so that we can ensure we can pay that. It also helps us with rate stability, right? To have a little bit of money so that we can ensure we can cover costs for a limited period of time without needing to raise rates immediately. What we're doing in this part of the analysis, bringing all of those pieces within one cohesive model and then projecting those out with the best knowledge we have today on thinking about the timing and how we might fund the capital project and the different types of funding sources that are available. This is an example here. We've done a number of studies for the city, and I've just put one example here of one of these financial models. What we do is there's a number of data sources that support this, but at the end of the day, we get to a graphic like this where we can put the model through its paces. And as we get to the conclusion of study, you'll see different iterations with different assumptions. And we may have to look at assumptions of higher capital investment rates, which will change the need for rate increases in the near term. We might have to look at personnel changes over time, which of course would change it. All of those things can be accomplished within this model. So we'll build in a number of scenarios with that underlying data so that we can then look. I'll oftentimes start out with a plan like this and just say, what's the diagnostic view? Let's assume we don't need any rate increases. How long can the utility operate before we need to? So it's not presupposing we need a certain level of rate increase. It's really building up from the bottom. What's that minimum necessary level of rate increases going forward to maintain sustainability on the system? One thing I wanted to put in front of you right here, which often kind of puts this in perspective, I've talked a bit about some of the elements and the cost pressure that push on the utility space. What helps me really think about this over the long term is this graphic right here shows from the turn of the century to the end of 2024, two inflation trends. One would be the overall consumer price index, the one you hear about in the news. That's in the orange color. There's also, though, in that consumer price index, a number of sub-indices that track all types of different consumer costs, and it just happens one is the water and sewage index. And it keeps consumption steady and looks at a bill as it changes nationally over time. And what you'll notice here is it's doubled the rate of inflation over here. So these cost pressures and the capital-intensive nature tend to push rates up nationally faster than the overall level of inflation. So it just gives us a little bit of perspective, and especially when we come, I think, to the end of this study and we put this in context, you'll typically see rate increases that are a bit above what you'd think is 3%, maybe the average inflation level that we tend to think about in the U.S. They've averaged, on average, a little over 5% over this time period for water and wastewater service, just to bring this out of the cumulative change and more on an annualized level. So what I get often asked when we put these analyses together is, what are the things that move the needle? I've mentioned a few of these already, but I just wanted to reiterate them. You know, when we look at the final scenarios here and the study starts to come to a conclusion, what you'll see is a number of scenarios around oftentimes the capital investment needs. And those, I should mention, are oftentimes relatively lumpy. And what I mean by that is they're not a few million dollars a year that just repeats. It's often in certain years we have much higher costs because we have to replace a big pump station, or we've got to replace a certain transmission main that's very expensive that's going to last for 30 or 40 years. And then we might have some slow years, and then it picks back up. So it has this jagged look to it on the capital plan. And the rearranging of that and the funding of that can have a very large impact on the annual level of needed rate increases. Operating cost pressures, those are often a little bit more predictable. Especially now that we've moved past that larger surge in inflation, it really helps us think about those on a long-term basis. But we do have to program those in, and we have to think about a continued increase in, say, chemicals on the water side and the level of cost that chemicals will likely go up over the next 5 to 10 years. Regulatory compliance, and then, of course, debt service. If we borrow any money or plan to borrow money, we've got to make sure that we can meet those obligations and show that we have the fiscal strength to be able to borrow that money, right, to get a good rate on that money and be able to repay it over time. So with that, I'll move on to the next step. Once we've answered how much money does it cost to run the utility on an annual basis and over the next 5 and 10 years, what we're then going to do is move over to a cost of service study. And so cost of service study, one way I like to phrase it is it's really an X-ray. So it's taking 1 year of expenditures, and we're going to do a really detailed analysis on it. We're going to break all of those costs up to think about the functions that they're attached to on that system. And I'll show you a graphic in a second. However, before we do that, there are very prescribed ways we go about the cost of service study. So the two manuals I have in front of you right here are within the industry, the guideposts that we will use to conduct a cost of service study. They're M54 and M1. They are just two different approaches. M54 is typically for smaller systems. For the purposes of the study we're undertaking, and I will be using the M1 approach. It is a much more data-intensive approach, and it functionalizes the cost to a much more detailed level to try to understand exactly where the dollars are going, how they're supporting the water from all the way from supply through that treatment out to the customers, and breaking that cost up so that then when we look at different customer usage, we can attach that data very clearly and follow each dollar from the top to the bottom of the process. This graphic right here, I think, sums it up in the best way I can. I almost think about this as if we're a detective to a certain extent on the top. I mentioned we're following the water. That graphic is a graphic showing that water all the way from supply to treatment. We then may need to push it through the large diameter transmission mains. We may have some storage on the system as well. And then finally, it'll oftentimes go through smaller mains, distribution mains, as we refer to it, to get to the final customers and then be metered. All of those different elements represent a function that we can then attach cost to. And the bar down at the bottom, you can see in this example, we're building up the full cost to provide that service over time. And you can think about it as well as I'm always matching the customer usage data. So the different functions provide different or customers use them in different ways, right? So the customer service functions, that's not really a function of how much water you use, it's more how many connections do you have on the system and the billing, whereas the diameter of the pipes and the supply, that's much more connected, right, to the amount of water we need to move from supply all the way out to customers and how much they're demanding. This is an example right here of some of that data. Again, I've mentioned it's kind of this meshing of data when we go through cost of service. Identify the cost, and then figure out how customers on the system are actually using the end product here, water. This is a graphic from another customer I have that's very similar here near Missouri. And what this just shows you is something I mentioned early on. Demands are not constant by customers or throughout the year. The orange line in here is actually, they have a very detailed way to measure hourly usage and some of the more advanced metering infrastructure and get down to very minute levels of measurement. And what you can see there is when you go through the summer, in this case, those are single family homes, they do a lot of irrigation. And that tends to peak the system in that period. And as I mentioned, the capacity's got to be there year round, right? When we install the system and we design and we build the system, we're not designing it, we have to design it for the peak flows that are going to occur on the system, because you can't uninstall it and then reinstall it. It's got to be there ready to go all year round. And this kind of data is what we attach to try to understand how different customers use the system and then how we should make sure we assign those costs for the particular usage that customers are demanding on the system. And then finally, we'll move on to rate design. So in rate design, it's where the rubber meets the road. We've got to craft now rates that can apply based on the measured characteristics of usage. What I've got up on the screen right now are the two primary rates that are in force right now that collect the revenue to run the system. And again, we'll be evaluating these as we look through the study this year. So on the top are the base charges. They are not tied to consumption, but rather when you have an active account, they are applied each billing period. They tend to scale by meter size. So the higher or the larger your meter size, the larger the base charge. These tend to recover fixed cost of the system, if you will. Now, the utility system has a lot of fixed costs, as we mentioned, because it's got a lot of infrastructure. This is a portion of fixed cost. And the reason you see that scaling is because larger connections to the system can demand a lot more water. And so it's representative of that fact that the potential demands can be much larger on the system over time. And on the bottom are the consumption side, or the volume side of the equation. And so there's a residential, commercial, and a large commercial class in place right now. They have the very similar rate structures that apply here at the bottom. There are three tiers in place, and the tiers are specific to each customer's usage, so they're expressed in a percentage. So tier one is 70% of your winter average usage, those months in the winter where you don't have irrigation that skews it. The next is 71 to 170% of that winter average usage, and then the third tier would be everything over 170. And so this creates these bands, if you will, that as you use volume throughout the year, you will fall in one of those tiers. The more water you use, you will fall in a higher tier. And it's very common in the water utility to have what's called an inclining block structure, where you pay more for each unit as you go up in the tiers. What that does is two things. It incentivizes conservation, right? So it incentivizes the most efficient use of water, recognizing this is a limited resource. The other item there is when we think about the cost of service, right? Peaking's a big dynamic here. And so we want to make sure we can attach those costs back to the customers that are peaking the system. And rates like this are one mechanism to do that, to make sure that you're properly accounting for that cost of that capacity and attaching it to the customers that are peaking the system during oftentimes the summer months. Not always, but the irrigation demands tend to be some of the larger demands on the system. Rate structure. So whenever we come in and we start to evaluate rate structure, it is really fundamentally best thought of as a balancing act. There are going to be a number of objectives that are oftentimes competing against one another. I put up on the left side of this chart a graphic that details a number of different rate structures. And I'll just talk about two to give you the kind of full picture here. One on the left is a fixed charge up there. So that's if you said, hey, let's just recover all of the revenue requirement on one fixed charge, a flat charge that doesn't vary. Really simple to administer, right? Really easy to think about. However, it's not really sensitive to the demands that different customers place on the system, right? And so the proportionality there is not necessarily in that rate structure. And you can go all the way to the other side. Oftentimes you'll see this on the West Coast, they'll do what's called water budgets. They'll actually design tiers on a customer by customer level to think about what those tiers should be for efficient usage. And so there's a wide breadth of different rate structures that could be implemented. And for each community, it's fundamentally thinking about these different objectives on the right to arrive at the right rate structure for the customers that the utility serves. And so that revenue stability versus the conservation signal, that goes right back to that fixed charge, right? The higher the fixed charge, the more stable our revenue is, but we don't get a good conservation signal, and we're not passing through that idea that it costs the utility more for peak demands. Some of the other items too we'll think about in a second as we go through, you know, revenue stability and the impact on low-income consumers as well. So the higher those base charges, the higher the charges at the bottom, those can have larger impacts on affordability for those customers that have lower income. Mention that in the next, as we look at affordability, there's two metrics that have been highlighted for us to consider. We'll be thinking about it from a number of different lenses, but there's two primary ones that the industry thinks about. So one of them is going to be hours at minimum wage. Right now in Missouri, it's indexed to inflation. I pulled the data the other day. It's $13.75 for a minimum wage in 2025. And the idea there is you look at the average bill and you think about how many hours it would take someone at minimum wage to work to pay that bill. And that gives you one sense of affordability. It's a metric for affordability that you can compare against other utilities or over time as the minimum wage changes as well. The other way to do it is what's known as the AR20, which is looking at essentially the affordability ratio at the 20th percentile income. So thinking about the distribution of income, looking at the 20th percentile, which is on the right side, right under the 25th. And the guidance there is that utility bill should not be over 2% of the income, is kind of the guidance in the utility. If you add water and sewer, it shouldn't be over 4%. So essentially it's thought of that over that that percentage, you start to get burdened by utility bills. Under that, it's thought to be affordable in the overall industry. It's one of the metrics that we use to kind of track over time. And of course, incomes change each year, right? So it's taking a snapshot to think about where we currently stand, and as these studies are done over time, seeing how it evolves over time. When we go through a rate structure change, and as I mentioned, there's usually several different options on the table for those changes, what we'll be doing at the end of the study is presenting those changes in a number of different ways, and I wanted to show you some examples of that. So one way would be a number of different residential homes or single-family users on the system. We'll often put this in a structure like this where we can say, what's the current bill? What is it under the new proposal? And any assumptions with regards to the usage. So often single-family homes are a 3/4-inch meter, 5/8 or 3/4, one of the two usually. They're usually on the smaller side of the equation. And then they have usually pretty similar usage. What we'll do is usually show a number of different users, though, say a 4-person household, maybe a 6-person household, because the rates will impact that slightly differently. And the changes will be slightly different depending on what we are looking at as options on the rate structure. And so often we'll try to package up those changes so that we can understand them, kind of what I would call at the kitchen table level, right? What is your bill going to look like the month before we make it, and then after we make the change, what's the expected change? The other thing that I see core to my job as we go through this study is making sure that we've got changes across the board accounted for, because there's going to be users that are different from everybody, right? And we've got to make sure we analyze that data in a way and express these changes so that we bring all those changes to the surface so you understand and we can make decisions on those rate structures and with the impacts in mind for all users on the system, not just the average, but the high and the low and different users that may use the service a little bit differently. And to that end, what we'll often do is tables like this, thinking about different large users. So again, an example here, we're just getting running on the study and analyzing all the bill data. But you oftentimes have, you know, a restaurant or different users that you think about that are bellwether in the community, and we'll surface them in this way so that we can see the relative change. In this case, non-residential users tend to be a bit different. They're driven more by their process and what they're doing that guides their water usage. And so it doesn't follow a simple average or a standard. So we've got to look at it through a number of different lenses to make sure we're capturing that change. And then, of course, we'll want to compare. So as part of the study, we'll be putting together a rate survey. What we do here is try to grab other peer municipalities that have the same services and then compare the rate for a given level of usage to understand where we are currently and if we make changes on the system, where we'll be in the future. The only thing I'll always mention on these when we put these up is these are really hard oftentimes, because while we're comparing the same service, doesn't mean everyone's in the same life cycle that we're in. They may have a much newer system. They maybe have done rates changes consistently each year. Some may haven't done one in the last 20 years and they need to do an 80% next year. And so there's always some interesting considerations, but we always want to know where we're at and always want to compare. We just have to know that there's going to be differences in the communities. They're all unique. And then next, I just want to cover the miscellaneous fees. As we continue to move through the study, one element will be looking at miscellaneous fees. And there's two components of that that are core to the study. Miscellaneous fees are best thought of when you need to call the utility for a specific service. So that might be a turn on, turn off. That might be a new tap or a new connection on the system. So they're not a standard fee that's charged every month. It's more of a one-time fee for a particular service provided to a customer. What we typically do as part of a study like this is we're going to want to drill down, and we have very detailed conversations with the utility to think about the manpower that's involved. So all the way from who picked up the phone, how long does it take them to put in the work order, who actually works on the particular service that's being provided, the materials associated with providing that service. And what we're doing through that process is building up a current cost basis. And what we'll do is then compare the current fee that's in place to the fully loaded cost. And what ideally we want to see over time is we're moving toward that fully loaded cost. We want to make sure the utility is recovering the cost to provide that service to customers. As we mentioned, many of the industry trends, the inflation over time, you know, personnel costs, that all impacts us one-time fees. These aren't often updated as much as rates. So it's very often that you'll go a number of years without updating this because it requires a very detailed study of the task and the materials used. And in communities, we'll update those every 5 to 10 years often. So it's not something like the operating rates that are tend to move around each year adjusting. The other component that we'll be looking at, and I would put this, you know, in the category of miscellaneous fees, is the connection fees. It's also, in the case of Columbia, called the water system equity charge. The broader envelope to think about these in is usually impact fees or connection fees. They are charges paid by new connections to the systems. And so what this is meant to recover is the idea that the city and its customers have already invested in a system. There are assets in place. When a new connection comes onto the system, this charge represents the buy-in, if you will, into the current system, ensuring that that new growth essentially pays for itself. Growth pays for growth, and existing customers aren't subsidizing that growth over time. And so in order to do that, there's three standard methodologies that we look at and determine which one is the best. So it's the buy-in method. That is where you've got a very mature utility, assets are currently in place. There's no big investments on the horizon to refresh those. That is purely backward looking, if you will. We think about the investments that have been made, and we bring them up to current day dollars using inflation metrics to replicate what it would cost us today to invest those. And we also think about the fact that there's some depreciation, right? Assets don't live forever. So they're somewhere in the middle of their useful life. We make those types of adjustments in the accounting for the buy-in method. Incremental is a little bit different. So incremental is where you've got a situation where you're going to make a really large generational investment. So let's say we have to bring on a brand new treatment plant. Well, that cost for that's often going to look very, very different than the one that was put in place maybe 40, 50, 60 years ago. So the incremental tries to take those costs in today's dollars and calculate the fee using that only, not the buy-in. So we exclude all the assets that were already put in place and just look at the incremental, recognizing that that's our best current measurement of the cost of capacity, especially when it concerns really large investments. And then when it makes sense, the combined method is used as well. It's kind of a hybrid between these two. So we do a buy-in, But we also say, hey, if we've got large investments that are coming in, let's try to combine those two together. So we get updated costs and we also get the historical cost to come up with an average cost for the connection. Each three can be applicable. We'll be looking as we analyze the asset data and the capital investment data as part of the study to make a determination on the best strategy to go forward here, the best method representing where we are at in the life cycle of the utility. This just shows the calculation a little bit more specifically and how we do that. So it's really the value of the system. We have to minus off some credits. I mentioned that. So there might be a few different credits that are in play when we think about it. It's really trying to get to the best estimate of what the current asset life or value is. So that might be if we had any grants that originally paid for part of the system. If we borrowed money, we have to make a adjustment on the principal because oftentimes that debt will be repaid in operating rates over time. So it's making these calibrating type adjustments to ensure these fees are as defensible as possible, but also represent that current unit cost of capacity. The other thing I'll mention on these, much like the base charges, these tend to scale as well. So the larger the connection to the system, they will typically pay a larger capacity fee, representing the fact that they can draw much larger quantities of water instantaneously. And so they're buying more of the system, if you will, as they buy into it. And then finally today, I just wanted to mention our project schedule here. And so the project has already kicked off when we've received a lot of data and already met with staff in a number of meetings on the revenue sufficiency. So we're moving along on that part of the study. And we expect to have that one in place by February. And then we'll be, with the results of that, moving directly into cost of service in the latter part of February. And in March will be rate design, so we'll take on and look at the rates that are in place and think about some suggested changes on the rate structure. Miscellaneous fees will follow that very closely in March, or maybe on a parallel track, if you will, looking at those buildup of costs as well as the capacity fee or the water equity fee. And then we'll provide recommendations, a full detailed report, as well as council presentation, our board presentation in the April-May time period would be when we'd get to a part where we're ready to bring and surface those recommendations for consideration and then ultimately some decisions to be made, right, on the levels of increases or the adoption of the changes in the rates or connection fees that are calculated as part of the study. And so it really does build upon itself over this period, and there's a lot of work that's already started and is gonna happen as we move through the February and March period to get to this cohesive study, if you will, that ties all of these different elements together using the really most current data we have available. And so that's all I have for today, but I'm happy if there's any questions or any thoughts as we've gone through these slides, you know, to bounce back to those, to have a conversation about them, and really make sure we hear your thoughts as we're still in the analysis phase so that we can consider that as we continue to go through the study. Got one in the back.
You made a comment in the beginning that says why that consumption decreases over time. Can you help me understand that a little better?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's really as simple as thinking about this as a washing machine in 1996 and one in today. And one of the big changes there is they use a heck of a lot less water. And think about that of all the different appliances that are in the household. So a dishwasher, many of these things have gotten much more efficient over time. And so they're using much less water. And therefore, we measure less water, we can bill less water. And we've just got to consider that as one key component of these cost of service study going forward, because what that will mean is that if that trend continues, right, you would have less revenue coming in on the volume rates over time. And so it's something that we consider, we think, and we process the data to make sure that we understand. It's unique in each community a little bit, right, because it depends on the housing stock, how old it is, and how it's being updated over time. The other thing I'll mention as well is fixtures as well, right, and the household have changed over time. They tend to use a lot less water as well. Think about your bathroom fixtures, your kitchen fixtures tend to use a lot less water. So that's what we're seeing in that study. I expect when we see that updated, like I mentioned, we're in that time period when they would update it. They only update it every 10 to 15 years, somewhere in that range. We're a little over 10 or closing in on 10 now. I expect to see very similar trends. It'll hopefully level off a little bit. We're seeing that in some areas with a lot of new homes, but it's definitely a trend that's been in place for a number of years, and we continue to see it.
Thank you. But so we have older housing stock. We have a 20% poverty rate in this town. People can't afford their housing or their utilities. And depending upon the condition of where you're living has a big impact on, say, your electric charges and other utility charges. Do you see a corresponding problem with that on the water side, aside from the age of the fixtures and the appliances? Is that how we need to think about that when we're trying to think about affordability?
Yeah, so a couple things come in with affordability, right? We've got a couple standard metrics we can watch right over time, and we can watch those evolve and understand the income dynamics. I think one of the other things you mentioned is there tends to be housing stock differences. That comes into play. There's another really big one, though, that typically comes into play, which is usually density as well. So oftentimes there's a correlation that I see when we look at the 20th percentile that there tends to be more people in the household. So they're bunking up, right? They've got more people. That means they're using more water, right? And they're potentially the bill's a bit higher, which is one of the reasons when we show those bill impacts, we're going to show it not only for your average, but we need to show it for households that are a bit larger to understand those impacts. Because those oftentimes, and I'm not saying it's the case here, but one of the things that we see correlated oftentimes is there is changes in occupancy. And those houses tend to have a bit more people. And because they've got, you know, more people and older fixtures, those bills could be a little bit higher than the average. So we just got to make sure we have our eye on that.
Thank you.
That's absolutely.
Helpful. One of the things that has concerned me over some years has been that the peak use during the summer does not seem to be covered by the additional capacity needed to meet the peak use. How well do you think that the charges at the upper end of the water usage is covering the additional capacity that the utility has to have?
Mm-hmm. So I hear two things in your question, so I'll break them down a little bit, because I heard one sounded to me more of a physical system limitation of capacity. What this study will really answer is when we break that cost up, right, for the peaking, and we can usually understand that pretty closely with the data, understanding the billing dynamics as well as the physical infrastructure that's installed, because there's going to be limiting capacities, usually on the treatment side, of the system. What we'll be able to do through this, and you'll see very clearly as we get to the results, is categorize the dollars that we have from an annual basis of what it takes to run the system. And they're usually broken up into a couple different categories. So I'll just go through those real quick, because you'll see those when it comes out in the results. And one will be the average capacity. So think about that as kind of the overall average use of the system throughout the year. The next is going to be your maximum day. So you're going to think about the maximum day that occurs on the system. And then there's one more that we stack on top, which is the maximum hour. Man, because you've got to kind of think about it on an instantaneous demand, right? When you open that valve up and just let the water run, and you've got a number of customers doing it, right? When they got those demands that come on and they stack on one another, that's the peak usage on the system. So it's broken up into three buckets. And those three buckets we clearly outline in that M1 cost of service study. So we're going to be categorizing those dollars as well as measuring that. And to your point, at the end of the day, what we want to make sure we do is attach those costs correctly. And so we'll be evaluating the current structure and looking at the differences. Oftentimes, the cost of service, when we get to a result, it's just a difference we're looking at. It's the same dollars overall in the same year, but we're saying, are we recovering it from the right places? And if we're not, what's the gap? And what would it take us to get to what you mentioned, full cost recovery in the right places? So that'll be a clear deliverable as this study continues and progresses through the cost of service into the rate design.
My impression is that the higher rates of use really do not cover the additional capacity that has to be added to permit that one-day use.
Mm-hmm. And so that'll be one thing that we'll be looking at as we go through the study is the assignment of that cost. And the comparison at the end of the cost of study will tell us how far we're off on that, exactly your question. It's one of those will be answered, because we will have a measurement in today's dollars, right, of what those cost buckets are and how close we are on the recovery of where it's recovered within the rate structure. So I'll have that answer. I don't have it today, right? So we're going through the analysis and pulling all the data together, but that'll be one clear answer as we go through the pools of those costs and how they're recovered.
Having looked at that budget in some detail in the past on occasion, my impression is that we have not been achieving that cost recovery for the peak use.
Understood. It'll be definitely something we'll be looking into as we go through the study.
You know, I was a bit confused about when you were talking about the tiers. You said something about it's based on an individual meter and the winter average.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm assuming the winter must be the lowest usage.
Yeah, it's a usage where you don't have irrigation in play as well, right? So you think about it, the way we'll typically think about it is use the term indoor domestic consumption, right? So it's the usage that's happening inside the dwelling unit typically is why we use that. It's kind of the minimum usage, and it's usually consistent.
Okay, so one of my confusions is if that's the lower period, the winter period,
mm-hmm.
why do we even need a 70 to 100%? I mean, it mm-hmm. would almost never, nobody would ever fall into that, because 100% of their lowest average is, you know, essentially the ceiling of this. So it would be very rare that you would even need a tier one. Why do we consider a tier one?
Well, so actually, I think about it. Okay, so let's use a little example, maybe two different accounts, maybe you and me, right? So we'll have potentially two different consumption patterns have been. Maybe my house is a little bit bigger, so my winter average will be a little bit different, might be a little bit higher, right? And in this particular rate structure, the way it applies is effectively it allows each person, based on their consumption patterns, to set that threshold, if you will, for tier one. You're going to use tier one all year round, right? That's your winter average, 70% of your winter average. Most folks are going to use that. Maybe you're out of the house for a month or something, so you fall under that, but most of the time you're going to fall on that. What these 70, 71, 170 are doing are creating the bands, if you will, as you go outside of that winter average period to create the inclining block, the conservation structure. And so essentially those percentages are how strongly that pricing signal is felt by consumers when they move outside of that average band, if you will, is why they're set where they're set. So again, I didn't do that rate structure, but that's the purpose of them, is essentially to create, and usually I use my hand like this, to create that conservation structure, the steepness of the slope. So depending on how those bands fall, they're either less steep or more steep, providing more of a conservation structure. So that's really what they're meant to do, and they're meant to size that based on each individual's usage characteristics, which is why they're the winter average.
Okay, so again, you're edifying me here. So you take your example that you just gave. You
sure.
use a little bit more than me.
Yeah.
So on in a period when we're both using our personal averages,
mm-hmm.
so we're both hitting 100%, you know, a month we both use 100% of our average, we're gonna pay the same amount?
Well, it'd be different because we have different. Maybe it's 5,000 versus 8,000 gallons, right? We may have different amounts of usage that fall in these tiers. So that's why they size a little bit
right.
differently.
Right. So, but mm-hmm. we'll be paying the same, you know, per gallon rate, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah, you will. So, yeah, the tiers will have essentially, effectively, they will interact with us the same way, even though we have slightly different base usage, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And do we have different base rate?
Well, we have, and I'm just going to use terminology so we're straight. The base rates are not based on consumption. That's the table up top. So the ones we're talking about, though, are in the bottom, right? The volume.
Yes. But
okay.
What I'm trying to understand is you're using 8,000 gallons, I'm mm-hmm. using 5,000 gallons. Is the only difference in our cost that I used less water than you? But, you know, so whatever, mm-hmm. 3 cents a gallon times 5,000, 3 cents a gallon times 8,000 is that the way the bills will be generated, or there's actually, for somebody who's using 8,000 gallons versus somebody who's using 5,000 gallons, on a regular, average, consistent basis, is there more expense chargeable to the person using
Yeah, so
more
these
water?
Are, yeah, it's a great point. And so we always go through this. So when we think, when we look at this, right, and we think of the 322, that is per 1,000 gallons of usage. So that is per consumption. So if I'm using more, I'm paying more of those 322 units.
Right.
So it does scale up in that way. Mm-hmm.
But you don't paying more for having a higher peak demand on the system.
No, because of the way these work, the tiers essentially structure in a way that the way they're applied is they'll look different for each customer because our base usage changes, but they shouldn't be more, I guess, punitive, I would say, to you or me. They'll apply in the same way because they're based off of our winter average. And we'll be looking at this as part of the study. We're going to pull this data down. I'll be showing you charts of who's in that from a bill distribution, the tier one, tier two, three. We'll be able to see this very clearly and how customers have interacted with this. So that's one of the key things here is there's a lot of data involved. And we're going to be pulling that data and understanding in a really detailed way how customers currently use the system and interact with these rates so that we can recommend changes in the future that make sense. So this will be clearly coming out in the study is the understanding of how those two different customers talked about are interacting currently. We're still processing that data. It's a lot. Yeah.
My last question.
Yeah,
thank you for
sure.
Being with me. You had a slide that said equity. And I, you know, that means so much to so many different people. And I was just curious, when you talk about equity in water systems, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, and so, and I think the one you're talking about is right here, it's the water system equity charge. So this is the official name for it.
It was even before that. It was like you were balancing.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think you're actually talking about here, perceived equity.
Yes. Yeah. There we are. Yeah.
Yeah. So another term that we'll use oftentimes is proportionality, and that might be even a better term to use here. The idea is that when we're picking rate structures at the end of the day, it's a question of how sensitive the rate structure is to different customers' usage and how that changes their bill, much of like what we were just talking about right now. And different rate structures will interact very differently with customers. And I mentioned that example of a fixed fee. You use zero water, you use a whole bunch of water, the fee doesn't change. There are other ones that are much more sensitive and move around. But again, we're balancing it because those are much harder to implement, and there's much more administrative costs with that. What we're really thinking about here, I guess the where I would take this back to your core question here is the equity, the proportionality. What we really want to make sure we're doing is that these rates work in a way that when we've identified the cost, much like the question asked before, what is the cost to run the system in these very defined functions, that these rates are sensitive enough to understand and apply those charges proportionally to the usage that different customers use on the system, because we know each customer doesn't look like one another. We know customers look very different. They need to have some sensitivity to pick that up. That's what we really mean there. And different rate structures can accomplish that in different ways, and we've got to try to balance it.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Columbia does not have an irrigation ordinance as far as controlling, you know, who irrigates and what days. Do you have enough experience to look at that system versus a community that has a system like that to see if there's long-term benefits of having that as far as cost of water service over time?
Yeah, so we've looked at that in a number of studies sometime. There's a lot of moving variables there, right? So you're speaking of an actual ordinance that says, hey, you can only water on the even days if you have this address, or you're limited to only these days. Is that what you're speaking of?
Yeah, it kind of goes with, like, Dick's question is, you know, we built a certain amount of capacity, and if we allow irrigation to continue and grow, there's going to be a demand for more capacity. And how do you avoid that over time? And can that be done with ordinance? For, you know, I think what we've tried to do as a community is those have those incline blocks and that top tier rate, and thinking the top tier rate is going to cause a lot of people to pull back their irrigation, but I don't know, think that that's really happened. People just pay the bill.
Yeah, that's what I'm really curious when we get into data, honestly, to understand the dynamics currently of how it's used. I guess what I can tell you from looking a couple different ways and how different utilities function, some will function in the manner you just mentioned. They'll put in very strict regulations around it. And the other variable there is the enforcement, right? Because you can tell people, hey, you're this, but it's the enforcement and how strong the enforcement is. Right. That typically will have some kind of impact. We'll see it, you know, clear as day when it's implemented and we can see the consumption go down. And if enforcement's even ratcheted up, it goes down a lot. What I'll tell you is most modern utilities are actually approaching this a little bit differently, and it's much more on the educational side of the equation and helping customers understand, do they have rain sensors in place? Are they irrigating an efficient level, or are they over-irrigating, right, and helping them understand the differences and calculating? And that's actually where I've seen a lot of results more recently, is making sure that there's a conversation with customers as opposed to that top-down. Sometimes that's not necessarily always the right reaction, and you actually get a bit more on the other side when there's more of a conversation, and even through the study, an understanding to this point that these peak demands are costly. And we have to make these investments, and that's why they show up in the rates. And when customers understand that, they can make better decisions. So
yeah, if you could understand how what of an impact if the city had some type of an irrigation plant could in order to reduce their infrastructure expense, because it's bigger pipes in the ground, it's more water towers, it's more production. So
it does. Yeah, no, and it definitely affects the time. The other thing I'll mention though, which is something to consider, these utilities operate in perpetuality, right? They're operating over long periods of time, really with no end date, right? And the assets are very long-lived. And the reason I make that point is it's not like we can just uninstall capacity either, right? We have a system in place. We've got to have the cost to maintain it. So even if you shave a little bit of that irrigation peak today, it takes a long time before we see those savings. They don't filter in tomorrow. It takes years and years and years before we can actually lower the investment, right, when it comes due.
Thank you.
Got one behind you.
Now you made me have another question. So his question was specifically, what about an ordinance? But my question is, you said, okay, education works better. But what about simply market information, like having more tiers as you start using a lot of water, and the price really goes up and you feel it in your pocketbook? So instead of a top-down ordinance, what if it's from the bottom up and the micro level people are responding to market forces? Do you see that, or do they just pay the bill happily and they don't actually change their consumption based on having higher bills?
No, we typically see pretty decent reaction when those charges get higher on the top. I mean, if you think about it right now and the way it's structured, if there's kind of two different configurations for irrigation. You might have one single meter going into a house and you're serving the indoor and the outside potentially using your hose, right? So you're going through the tiers likely. In that case, you're getting higher. But if you have a standalone irrigation meter, you're actually getting charged that tier three in the summer. So you're getting that full rate in the summer for all of that. You don't get the benefit of the lower consumptions because we already know now that's usually much more seasonal water. To your point though, when we see changes, when we've done pricing changes over time, and through the cost of service study, identified a cost basis reason to increase those rates, we do see pretty significant behavioral changes over time. Because just to your point, customers react. They see that bill at the kitchen table, and they go, how can I control my costs, right? And they will tend to pull some consumption back. It's something we have to carefully consider, right? Because that's revenue, too. So we've got to make sure it's a balancing act there. We've got to make sure we've got the conservation signal. But if we're going to see a behavior reaction, we've got to make sure we account for that, too. So we do see it. It works. Thank you for the questions, by the way. It's wonderful to have that kind of interaction and consideration for what you're thinking as you see this.
Well, I'll give this to you in writing as well as here. One of my concerns has been lead in the pipes. My impression is that the city pipes don't have any. I'm not entirely sure that's accurate, but I think it's a reasonably close approximation, and that the lead is coming from customers' pipes. I think we need to encourage customers to pay attention to that. And the easiest way to do that is to provide free testing for lead so that the customers can know that they have a problem and that is likely coming from their pipes. At some point, I think we need to require that in rental properties, but I think it's useful across the board. And one of the reasons rental properties need it is that on average, they are older than residential. How average? Thank you.
Thank you for the comment. All right. Well, appreciate everybody's time tonight. This has been wonderful. Thank you so much.